Turn in your Bibles to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2, we're going to look at the last several verses of that chapter there. It tells us again of what Christ has done for us as we remember in communion. What we are remembering is the suffering of Christ. What we are remembering is the sacrifice of Christ for us. It's a time that we have set aside and that Christ has set aside for us to consider what Christ accomplished on the cross to purchase our salvation. And so what I want us to do this morning is I want us to take time to just consider the substitution of Christ for us. The fact that Christ, when he died on the cross, took our place and bore our punishment. So that Christ was our substitute. In his death, suffering the punishment that had been intended for us and paying the penalty that we owe. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 22, speaking of Christ, says, "Who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. Who when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. Who his own self bare our sins in his own body on the tree, that we being dead to sin should live unto righteousness, by whose stripes ye are healed." I use the word substitution. It's a very important word in we understanding our salvation. It is what Peter says here in 1 Peter, that he did no sin. But in verse 24, that he in his own self bare our sins in his own body on the tree. As it says in Corinthians, that he that knew no sin became sin for us. And marvelous truth, a vital truth, that Christ became our sin, that he took our sin so that we who were under the just condemnation of God, we who were under the wrath of God, that Christ came in and essentially took us out of that place, and he bore that condemnation and he bore that wrath of God for us. So that we who are redeemed sit here this morning, saved, forgiven, having been reconciled to the Father, now being made the sons and daughters of God, because Christ has taken fully the punishment that we deserve. So that all of it has been taken off of us and has been put upon Christ. That's what I mean when I say substitution. But to really understand what this means, we have to understand the magnitude of sin. Because it says, again in verse 22, Christ did no sin, but he bore our sin. And if we can understand, for us to understand that what Christ has done, we have to understand just how serious sin really is. We look at sin and we judge it on a graded scale. Let me give you an example. You know, in the American legal system, we have several different, a whole host of different degrees of crimes. So if you drive down the road and you exceed the speed limit, you're in danger of being ticketed and having to pay a fine. You know, you might even get a warning depending on the situation there. It is relatively trivial. If you were to drive down the road at 100 miles an hour, you would be ticketed and probably charged with reckless driving, facing a fine and potentially the loss of your driver's license. If while driving that fast down the road, you caused an accident, the offense increases and you now have committed something along the lines of reckless endangerment. If you flee the scene of that accident, you have now committed a felony hit and run. If someone in the other car dies, you could be charged with negligent homicide or potentially manslaughter. If you were drunk when this happened, a whole host of other charges would be added to that. And if you set out intentionally to kill the person in the other car, then you could be charged with murder. You see how that same event, as we have a whole graded scale of treating that crime, and that's legitimate. I'm not saying it's illegitimate to do that. Obviously, none of us would want to be thrown in jail for life the first time we got a speeding ticket. We recognize that there's a legitimate grade there when we are treating offenses. However, we cannot view our relationship with God in that same respect. As we come to our sin, God does not view sin on a graded scale. We go through scriptures and we understand how God views sin. Not one sin is trivial. All of them are major offenses, so that from the very beginning, sin was always a big deal. So that God placed Adam and Eve in the garden, and he told them on the day that they disobeyed him, they would surely die. Genesis 2:17. When they disobeyed God, they were that very day separated from him. That is death. That is genuine spiritual death, and that is the reason why physical death occurs. They were that day separated from God, and for that one sin, Adam, Eve, the serpent, all humanity, and all creation were cursed. And all they did was eat a piece of fruit. If we're going to compare this the way we think about it, this is something most of us would say, they just ate a piece of fruit. God does not treat sin as trivial. Any disobedience, any offense against him is horrible. Listen to what else God says about sin. It says in Psalm chapter 5, it says, "For thou art not a God that hath pleasure in wickedness, neither shall evil dwell with thee. The foolish shall not stand in thy sight. Thou hatest all workers of iniquity." Proverbs 21 says, "The sacrifice of the wicked is abomination. How much more when he bringeth it with a wicked mind." So when a wicked man with a wicked mind brings a sacrifice to God, God does not say, "Oh, that's nice." God hates it. It is abominable to him. It is something that he abhors because he hates sin. Habakkuk 1:13 says, "Thou art of purer eyes than to behold iniquity, and canst not look." "Thou art of purer eyes to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity." So as we look at, again, our understanding of sin, I might tell a white lie to somebody. I might pick on my mother-in-law. I might tell a white lie to Gloria. And I might mean it with the best of intentions. And it might have a minimal impact upon my relationship with her. But that same white lie will have a major impact upon my relationship with God. It will as surely hinder my walk with him as malicious slander does. God does not look at it and say, "Oh, he meant well. I understand, you know, his circumstances. He really just he couldn't stand what she was feeding him, but he meant well. He didn't want to hurt her feelings." So I don't do that. I tell her when I don't like her food. And God doesn't look at it and say, "Oh, that's okay, I'll excuse it." God treats every sin as an offense against him, because at the root of all sin is selfish pride that wants to exalt myself above everything else. Okay, I'm going to pick on her. I hope she doesn't mind. I'm going to pick on her anyway. She invites me over to her house. She invited me over to her house and fed me, goulash. Spaghetti stuff, I think it's, what it is. But she invites me over and feeds me goulash. And I'm looking at it, and I'm not. But let's say I'm looking at it, "Oh, I hate goulash. This is the most awful stuff anybody's ever invented. Why is she feeding me this again?" And I look at her, and I say, "Your goulash is wonderful."
Smart.
At the root of that is, at the very least, a little bit of self-preservation. I want her to invite me back down again. I want her to feed me some more. Maybe something better. And I don't want her to be mad at me. And I don't want her daughter to be mad at me as a result of her being mad at me. And what it gets down to, and really, and there's probably some of that I'll justify, I don't want to hurt her feelings. But there's a whole lot of just selfishness involved in that. And I do not want her to be mad at me. I do not want this relationship to be difficult. And therefore, I'm going to tell her, your goulash is wonderful. The reality is, it is just pure selfishness. Maybe with a little bit of concern thrown in. But it's selfish. That is the problem with sin. Right there. It is selfish. It is my pride standing up and saying, I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm going to operate in the way that I think is best, rather than in the way that God has declared to me to be best. So that you go back to the Garden of Eden, and Satan begins to tempt Eve. He begins to tell her, this fruit is good for you. This fruit is best. God is withholding something from you that you really need. And at the point that Eve decides she's going to take that fruit and eat it, she has decided that she determines best better than God, and that she is the author and the director of her own life. At the time she takes it to Adam and she hands it to Adam, Adam says, I know better than God. I am going to operate based upon my own decrees rather than upon the decrees of God. And what they have done is they have set themselves up to know better than God. They have set themselves up as the ones who decide what to do rather than submitting themselves to God, who has already declared to them what to do. And that is the root of our sin. That is where sin began, and that is that in its most basic form is why we continue to sin today. Because we still have that nature within us that desires to decide rather than to obey. We have that built into us that wants to be in charge. And so whether it be something trivial or whether it be something major, all of them are a denial of the godhood and the authority of God. So all of them are significant. They are major. We keep going, though. Because to understand this fully is not just, the fact that we are usurping God, is also the fact that we are offending a perfectly holy being. An infinitely holy being. Grace is in here. I'll pick on my daughter here. We have, a candy jar in the house where we keep candy, amazingly. And we have certain restrictions on that candy jar. And imagine I tell Grace, you may not eat any of the candy in the candy jar. This whole week, no candy, period. Don't touch it. And I come home and she's got a great big sucker sticking out of her mouth that I know has come from the candy jar. Has she disobeyed me? Absolutely. Is there going to be consequences to that? Absolutely. Am I going to kick her out of the house and say, you're never coming back in my home? No. The offense would be outrageous, or the response would be of kicking her out, saying, you're never coming back, you're not my child anymore. That is outrageous for the offense that is committed. Because, really, the reason is outrageous is because the declaration, the command, comes from me, a finite, imperfect being, given to another finite, imperfect being. And so I have given this instruction to her. In his offense, there will be consequences. But she has not, it can never be said that I have not sinned against her. And obviously I've sinned in many, many ways. Just in general. My holiness is, it's not existent, and it's definitely not infinite. She has not violated my holiness in any way. She has violated a command, an instruction, but that's it. When we come to our relationship with God, we are coming to a being who is infinitely holy, whose holiness knows no bounds, who has never done wrong, who has never given a bad instruction, who has never made a mistake, whose holiness is eternal from eternity past to the eternity future. It's a holiness that is without limit. And so when we sin against God, we are not just offending another limited being who has also offended other limited beings. We are offending the limitless God who has never offended at all. And that obviously, that takes the severity of our crime and it ramps it up even more. What is lost in that crime, what is lost in that disobedience to God, is a relationship with the Creator God of the universe. What grace loses by disobeying my instruction, it may be desserts for a week, it may be some privileges, it's going to be very limited. She's not really, in the big scheme of things, not losing a whole lot. When we sin against God, when Adam and Eve sinned against God, what is lost is the close personal relationship with the infinite Creator God of everything. There is no greater loss. There is no loss more significant than that. Our sin is a monstrous evil because it offends the holiness of God. And we see it just all through scriptures. Over and over again, from Isaiah and Ezekiel, the Psalms, Book of Revelation, 1 Peter, we see the Gospels referring to Christ's holiness over and over again. We find the holiness of God described time and time and time again. And it's our culture now has emphasized as the major characteristic of God is love. And it's true, God is love. Absolutely is biblical truth. God is holy as well. And Scriptures emphasizes His holiness. So that we cannot emphasize His love over His holiness. Really, one cannot be emphasized over the other. The Bible teaches them both to be infinitely true of God. So that we can take this and we look at it and we say, God is infinitely love. God is infinitely holy. And God gets to define both of those things. I don't get to define what it means when I say God is love. God defines God as love. I don't get to define what it means when I say God is holy. God defines what it means when God says God is holy. And so for us to understand this, really, in God's holiness, infinite holiness, it means that we have committed an infinite crime. Because we have offended the infinite, eternal God of all, whose major characteristic is that of holiness. So at no time is any of our sin a little thing. For every single failure to do God's commands is a crime of the highest possible magnitude. Let me say that again. Every single failure to do what God commands is a crime of the highest possible magnitude. Sin has no limit in its severity because the one I have sinned against is limitless. And the consequences, therefore, of this sin has to be limitless because the offense of sin is limitless. Limitless. That is why an eternity of suffering in hell is the only just payment that a man can make for sin. As a limited being, the only possible way I can begin to pay an infinite penalty is for the payment of that crime to stretch for infinity. That also is why only God is able to pay the full penalty of our sin. God is limitless, and so He could there on that cross during those 6 hours satisfy the infinitely offended holiness of God. Sin is no trivial matter. That's where we have to start. Christ became sin for us. He did not sin. He knew no sin. And this sin is something we are familiar with, have known all of our lives. But none of it is trivial. All of it demands infinite payment. And Christ taking our place, Christ being our substitute, paid that penalty. Consider again that he knew no sin. He did no sin. Christ had not, for even the briefest of moments, known guilt. He had never felt the prick of his conscience. He had never suffered the fear of being found out. Never at any point had there been the least of sin. Christ, most especially, had never known separation from God. And then on that cross, Christ has piled upon him the full weight of the guiltiness of mankind's sin. And there on that cross, Christ felt the infinite payment, the infinite condemnation, the infinite guilt of mankind. And on that cross, Christ felt fully the consequences of our sin. So that suddenly the Son of God is fully condemned. He is separated from His Father. So that in His own flesh, He bears the punishment of our sin. That is why Isaiah and Peter both say, by His stripes we are healed. That is why Christ, as the sinless lamb, was numbered among the transgressors. So that is why the one in whom all the world would be blessed became cursed for us. Salvation was accomplished at Calvary because Christ took our place. Not just because he was a martyr. Not just because he was innocent and unjustly slain. Not just because he showed us how to live. Not even just because he was perfect. Christ's death accomplished salvation because at that point on the cross, he stood before the throne of God and he took the totality of the condemnation that was yours and mine. He took our place fully. He stepped in my place and endured to the fullest the wrath of God on my sin. So in 2 Corinthians 5:21, we are told, Christ became sin for us. So when Christ died on the cross, he died exactly as if he had sinned. There was no lessening of the judgment. There was no gentleness shown because Christ was the Son of God. Christ was treated as if he himself had offended the holiness of God. Christ bore the infinite wrath of the infinitely offended holy God. It was not that God and Christ play-acted. Christ truly and fully became our sin. He himself became the affront to God that our sin was. So that he took all of sin's horridness upon himself. So that Galatians 3:13 tells us that Christ became a curse for us. And stop for a moment and think of what it means to be cursed by God. Go back to the Garden of Eden in your mind and think of what that means, that the whole creation was cursed. As Romans 8 says, all of creation groans and agonizes because of the curse. Because of the curse of sin, Adam and Eve were cast out of that garden. They were sent to work in drudgery, no longer working in joy. They were enduring pain and suffering throughout their life. We can go on and we can walk through the scriptures and we can see instance after instance of God's cursing upon men. I think of the flood. The entire destruction of everything on the earth except for that which was in, or all the breathing animals on the earth except for those which were in the ark. The total reshaping of the continents and all that has happened as a result of that. We can go after the flood to the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. As God is pouring down fire and brimstone upon those cities. We can go on to the other end of the Bible, the book of Revelation. And we see as the fullness of the wrath of God is poured out upon the earth, the horrendous destructions that are displayed. as God's curse is fully unleashed in just indescribable torment, really, even for that brief period of time. So when it says that he became a curse for us, it's not just a nice poetic phrase. It means it was bad. He endured the total wrath of the judgment and the condemnation of God. He bore it all on the cross. And the greatest of the human catastrophes pales beside the full judgment that Christ paid on the cross. He was cursed for us, enduring the awful agony of total separation from the Father. And what we remember today, really what we rejoice in, but we also should grieve over, is that Christ bore the fullness of our sin. That he paid the penalty that was not his for us. As we remember communion, we are remembering a body that was broken so that we could be healed. As we remember communion, we are remembering blood that was poured out so that we can be cleansed. We are remembering what Christ has done for us. Psalm 22, you have a passage there in your bulletin, and it's an insert. Psalm 22 is a prophecy of Christ. It is David speaking in his own misery, but also speaking prophetically to that which Christ would endure. Let me read some of these verses here for you. It says in verse 1, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me and from the words of my roaring?" As Christ there cried out upon the cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? As he felt the wrath of God. It says in verse 3, though, Psalm 22, thou art holy, O thou that inhabitest the praises of Israel. In verse 7, describes some of what happened. All they that see me laugh me to scorn. They shoot out the lip, they shake the head, saying, he trusted on the Lord that he would deliver him. Let him deliver him, seeing he delighted in him. Verse 3, it says, they gaped upon me with their mouths as a ravening and a roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted in the midst of my bowels. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaveth to my jaws. And thou hast brought me into the dust of death. For dogs have compassed me, the assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I may tell all my bones, they look and stare upon me. They part my garments among them and cast lots upon my vesture. But be not thou far from me, O Lord, O my strength, haste thee to help me. That is just a brief description of what Christ endured on that cross. Just a brief reminder of what he has done for us. Our response should be verse 22. I will declare thy name unto my brethren. In the midst of the congregation will I praise thee. Ye that fear the Lord, praise him. All ye the seed of Jacob, glorify him and fear him, all ye the seed of Israel. For he hath not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, neither hath he hid his face from him. But when he cried unto him, he heard. We can rejoice this morning. As awful as the suffering of Christ is, as grievous as it is, we can rejoice because he did so knowing our affliction. Hearing our cry, he did so having already determined to redeem us. We can rejoice this morning and say, my praise shall be of thee in the great congregation.